Mitch Kiner's on the line, and we're thrilled to have Mitch back again. And of course, we're focusing on mergers and acquisitions. Now, Mitch has been instrumental as the chairman and managing partner of Wiener Brodsky Kiner in so many areas of the industry. So if we're specializing on anything, we could have Mitch on as a guest. He covers literally every aspect of it. So we're going to try to focus on some mergers and acquisitions, although we're going to get tempted to steer off into a couple other areas. But Mitch, I just want to welcome you back. It's been a little while since we've had you on, and we're going to fix that in 2018. We're going to have you back a lot more. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here with you.
Well, let's stay focused on the M&A area. Talk from your perspective about the trends. The latest announcement that Guild is buying Cornerstone, and we need to put a big caveat out there. This is not the Cornerstone in Houston. This is the Cornerstone in St. Louis. But this didn't take you by surprise when we raised it just before we talked. Sounds like you were involved in some way, shape, or form or working on it. So what are the trends and any insights you can give to what's going on and what we can anticipate in this important area in 2018?
So, David, I would start by saying, generally speaking, M&A activity has increased, I think, rather significantly in the past year, and I think it's going to increase even more so in 2018. I mean, some companies are looking for economies of scale, and certainly that's something that comes into play when you look at a deal like Guild purchasing Cornerstone, a St. Louis company. And, some companies that are looking to acquire are looking into getting to markets that they hadn't been in before. So in that particular example, Cornerstone opens up a really nice Midwest market for Guild. So I think that's going to be a deal that works out for all parties. Some parties are looking for better technology, and they sell for that particular reason. Technology has become all the more important and will become even more and more important in the origination part of the business as well as the servicing part of the business. And, smaller companies and even mid-sized companies can't necessarily keep up with the best of the technology that is out there or available for them. And some companies, in all honesty, are looking for better relationships in the secondary market. Margins are down. Margins are tight. Yeah, they're not what they were about a year and a half ago or so. And so the cost of originating is more expensive. Cost of servicing, is somewhat expensive too. Those margins have never been all that good. And the truth is, another trend that you see out there is a lot of aging baby boomers, such as myself, are, trying to cash out. It's time for them to get out of the business. They've had a great ride. They've been doing it for 30, 35, 40 years or so, and it's time to cash out. So those are the trends, and they're going to continue, I think, even more so in 2018.
That's encouraging to hear you say, and encouraging, but what are some of the challenges this brings? If you look at this, are we going to have fewer companies? Are you seeing a crop of new companies coming in? We're seeing evidence of that. There seems to be a whole new, I use the analogy of a forest fire. When you have a forest fire going through, and I don't like that, it's destructive, but consolidation usually is positive when done right, get the right people involved in. But when you do have that, it opens up sunlight, brings in opportunities for smaller startups. Are you seeing those trends as well, Mitch?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the overall trend that you're seeing today is one of consolidation. And as I said, people getting out of the business and companies consolidating into larger business. But trends have a way of changing over time. And you could already see the seeds of that happening as well. There have been a number of examples of larger players that have been getting out of the mortgage industry. Capital One decided it was going to get out of the origination business. Others are getting out of that business as well. And so you've got managers, employees of those banks and larger that were with larger companies, and they're going to go work somewhere, quite frankly. And you're seeing, little spin-offs, for lack of a better term, and you're seeing other entities that are rising. And the private equity market seems to have a real interest in mortgage banking today. And so you're seeing them not only acquire, but start some companies as well.
It's an encouraging trend. And they're really well capitalized. Obviously, if private equity firms are getting involved, they're well capitalized, but we're seeing more, even some of these startups that are independently owned. That's probably the one new trend I see in the other side of that is the new growth that's happening within the industry. It's a very well capitalized number of new startups. I want to run the mic over. Let's first go to Joe and then Alice and Andy and Alan. Let's get some questions regarding the trends. And then I want to go into eventually the mistakes here in a few minutes. So let's start off with Joe.
Yeah, so we were just talking about, you know, the big institutions buying what are likely family kind of owned businesses. And I was wondering, Mitch, in that environment, what does an owner-operator who wants to sell but continue to you know, manage his part of the operations, what does he do in a transaction where he's being acquired by one of the big institutions, one of the, you know, the Wall Street firms? Is there still an opportunity for that person?
You know, in some instances, there's an opportunity for that person. And, you know, you raise a good point through that particular question. Before anyone makes a determination to sell, they need to sit down and think through what it is they ultimately want to do. Do they want to stay in the company? Do they want to maintain an ownership interest in the company? Do they only want to sell a piece of the company itself? And then they, you know, they have to look for and structure a deal along those particular lines. For the most part, you know, if you're going to sell to a large Wall Street company, as you put it, you know, there'll be an earnout because earnouts are still very important to these to the transactions that are taking place today, which will keep those individuals at the company for a certain point of time. But for the most part, you know, when the earnout period is done, many, many of those former owners end up leaving the company itself. So it's important to think through what your horizon is and what you want to see happen in the future, because there are different players that will acquire your business, that will offer you different things along those particular lines.
Alice, let's get you involved. Questions?
Oh, great. Hi, Mitch. So I have a question about value, right? And what is value in buying today? So traditionally in years past, it was the value of the servicing or the value of the book of business, the value of the originators. It seems to me today that process also plays value in technology. Can you talk a little bit about what the latest trend is and what people really want to pay for today? Since there's a lot non-servicers out there who are looking to build their ability to be purchased.
So that's a great question, Alice. I mean, different companies have different values for different reasons. That's exactly right. So technology is a prime example of it. You know, a company that is technologically advanced, a company that can offer something by way of streamlined and more efficient processing that lower the cost of production, obviously has a much greater value than a company that otherwise can't do something along those particular lines. I mean, there are all kinds of different things that people will place value on today. I actually think that a lot of what's going on in the marketplace and a lot of what's going to go on in the marketplace still has to do with market share. And it's a matter of where you are, where you're located, how can I pick up more market share along those particular lines. That still plays a pretty big role in value from my perspective. And I think that's probably something that, you know, if you look at the Guild transaction, that's probably something that Guild thought about as well when they thought, you know, it's time for us to really enter into the Midwest market. So there are a number of different factors that come into play, and there isn't just one thing that you can put your finger on that says, okay, this is the golden key. This is what takes it there. Different companies are you know, have different needs and are looking along those particular lines.
Very good point. Really good point. I think, you know, when you come to geographic locations and getting into markets you're not, I think this most recent announcement that came out on Friday about Guild acquiring Cornerstone up in St. Louis is a great example of that. Andy, let's get you in on this, on the trend part of this discussion.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks, Mitch. Just as a side note, tag along to what Mitch just said, and Dave, you mentioned I'm in the doctoral program. So one of the things in business that we look for is a market differentiation that drives a competitive advantage. That's kind of the theory behind some of this stuff. And so you can boil it down to some of those key terms that ultimately figure out why people do what they do, but they're kind of usually driving to, how do I stay competitive? How do I sell more or spend less doing the same thing? So Mitch, when you're dealing with someone who's trying to sell and they're trying to figure out, you know, what they're really worth, and people want to get paid up front, and a lot of times there's an earn-out, but people want as much upfront as they can. What are you seeing trend-wise in terms of the payout? Are people actually able to get funds upfront, or is it almost always heading toward the earn-out process?
Well, a lot of it still heads toward the earn-out process. And obviously, you know, if you're selling your company, you need to be very careful about that, because an earn-out is by no means guaranteed. And in this industry, as well as the general marketplace itself, you don't necessarily know what's going to happen next year and the year after that. So, you know, I've seen transactions, and I'm sure you have as well, Andy, where there was an expectation for a specific earnout, and that expectation simply wasn't met because of factors that were not within the control of either of the parties. But the industry still relies heavily upon earnouts. So, you know, if I'm representing a seller, I want to get as much as I can up front. And anything that's coming by way of an earnout, I want to keep on a very short leash, a very short period. I don't like going beyond 3 years, quite frankly, from an earnout perspective. And as I said, I try my best to get that money right up front. If I'm a buyer, obviously, it's a little different.
That's so true. I mean, probably one of the best examples of that was when we sold our last mortgage company. We sold it to a Wall Street firm. We sold it in 95. We had a 5-year earnout. Guess what happened? Long-term capital blew up the liquidity in the markets. Our company, which is had a market cap of $1.3 billion that acquired us with only 20% of the shares traded, blew up and went away. I mean, they filed bankruptcy along with many other big institutions. You remember that day? It was just an ugly day. So these are good examples of factors. We had a good attorney back then, but I really wish we had you in there. We would have shortened that buyout, and we would have done all right. Much better. I wish.
Well,
so that's a little.
I was going to actually mention your fiasco that you experienced, but ultimately, earnouts are, you're a creditor. You are relying on someone else to pay you something in the future. So
that's
it sounds
good.
Like that you're the master of your destiny, but rarely is that the case.
Yeah, and there's these black swan events. And Mitch, when we had you on this program talking about this topic another time, you clearly said, I do not recommend going out more than 3 years. In fact, you try to get it done sooner. So it really comes down to having wisdom, listeners, and that people that have been through this journey, through this rodeo, and it does seem like a rodeo at times, and this is just an absolute push to get a hold of Mitch Kiatter. He knows what he's doing. He goes, if you're a seller, especially if you're a seller, he knows and he'll keep your interests, best interests in sight. Alan, let's get into the aspect of the, looking at the clock here and want to move it through technology. We're seeing a lot of technology opportunities for mergers. You consulted several right now yourself. So any questions for Mitch in that vein?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could spend all day talking to Mitch. I've been involved in some myself. But you know, it's kind of funny, Mitch, is that technology vendors in the mortgage industry, everything is the same but different, right? You have the different assets, but they all mean the same thing. And you do look for, you know, as you were saying, Andy, the differentiator and what are you doing different or how far ahead are you than your competition? But ultimately, I think that there is a lot of consolidation that will occur, is my opinion, because there's a lot of people that ran forward to hit the market and trying to find what they thought digital mortgages. And so there's going to be a lot of earnouts, right? There's going to be a lot of paper acquisition. But I also think there's a lot of confusion. I think that even starting a new company, a lot of people think that, hey, we'll just distribute X amount of shares. Those shares, you know, then we'll go and we'll raise some capital. And I don't think they understand the true process of pre-money valuation, post-money, anything in that area, thinking about technology vendors in our industry you want to chat about?
I missed the last part. You broke up a little bit over there.
Yeah, you did break up.
One more time.
Just the dilution of their value, thinking that, you know, they're worth more than what they actually are, and at what point in their
growth have they... We're talking about technology.
Have they,
yeah.
That's right. On the technology side of our industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, first of all, on the technology side of your industry, you've seen a fair amount of consolidation there alone, quite frankly. I mean, just look at everything that Ellie Mae has done and look at the Ellie Mae acquisitions. One of your sponsors here is Finastra, and Finastra had a fantastic deal when they bought up D&H. So there are a lot of different examples of you know, the consolidation in that part of the industry, and that's going to continue as well. Okay, as you put the technology piece into the mortgage banking consolidation that's taking place, It's interesting because you really have to find the company that either, if you're a buyer, you have to find the company that could fit within your system and in your structure and otherwise benefit from that. And if you're a seller as well, you've got to be compatible along those particular lines. But in terms of, you know, the valuations that take place and the value of technology that it ultimately brings, the reality is you're typically not selling your company because you're bringing value to it by way of technology. You're typically looking for the acquirer that's going to make your life easier, that's going to have the proper technology that you're going to be able to fit within so that you can make more money and do it in a more efficient manner.
Good point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there is some unique opportunity where lenders are looking to be different by offering different channels of business based on the technology they can acquire. So there's some consolidation from lenders acquiring technology solutions. You actually are hearing about large capital investments being made in certain technology vendors because they want to steer and have directional advice on their roadmap. So yeah, it's an interesting time for our industry and mergers and acquisitions, I would say. 2018 is going to be quite exciting.
It's going to be a lot of activity. And one of the mistakes, I want to move over to the mistakes to avoid. We've already talked about having too long of an earnout. That's one mistake I tripped over, and we had in our situation had a huge financial consequence. But it's also interesting that we got a huge multiple because of the technology we had in there. So they were acquiring us both for our business model, which was consumer direct early on, and because of the technology, proprietary technology that we built in the system. And so our mistake was we went too long. So we've already talked about that one. What are some other mistakes that you advise your clients to be careful of or be aware of as they enter into what is considered probably one of the more exciting events? Everyone's hopeful. It's like a wedding. Everyone's looking forward to it. And then there's the day after, Mitch. And what are the things that you would advise them to do so there's a happy day after?
So I love that analogy to it being a wedding because, you know, let's start off with the most basic and fundamental mistake that's made. And that is people look at it solely as a business transaction, forgetting to think about how the two different cultures are going to mesh together. And it's a huge mistake to either acquire a company or to be acquired until you've examined and you know and understand the people on both sides of the transaction. Very, very important. Same thing with a wedding, quite frankly. That marriage isn't going to last if, in fact, your values are different and you come at it from such a different perspective. And that's the same thing that deals with mortgage banking entities itself. So first and foremost, make sure it's a good fit, not just from a pure business perspective, but from a cultural perspective as well. I mean, is this the kind of company that you think you'll do well in? And do they in fact operate in a way that reflects the same and similar values? Do they treat their employees in a similar fashion? Because you're going to want to hold on to your employees, especially when you have that earnout that you're otherwise waiting for. So that's critical. Okay, I would put that number one on the list. Number two on my list, obviously, would be what we already talked about, and that is relying upon these earnouts. You know, as we said, those are just contingent. There's no guarantee, and you really don't know what's going to happen. And so we've seen many mistakes along those particular lines. People also go into these transactions. You know, we spent a fair amount of time already talking about value and price. And a lot of sellers walk into these transactions without a realistic idea of what value they're bringing to it. And that's something that they have to figure out in advance, because otherwise they're going to be very disappointed at the end of the day. And more, I'm seeing others jump into transactions because they think that it's going to help them in the secondary market, or it's going to give them greater access to warehouse financing and you know, all of those things are obviously, you know, essential tools to growing your business. But they also provide great opportunities for a buyer to hold the company that they purchased to a certain extent hostage in the future as well. Secondary market and warehouse relationships can be built up over time. They're important, and it's great if someone brings that to the transaction. It can help. But sometimes I see a little bit too much of an emphasis that's otherwise being placed on that. I will tell you the number one mistake, the most frustrating thing that I see as an attorney is when the transactions come to me and there has already been an executed letter of intent. Now, this is solely a legal matter, but once that letter of intent is executed,
so
even though it's non-binding for the most part, other than, you know, some provisions that deal with confidentiality, the reality is once that letter of intent is executed, the expectations are set, and they're there. And someone's going to be disappointed, you know, if in fact they think, you know what, it's just a letter of intent, and I'm going to come back and say, no, that didn't really work for me, and I'll do something else along those lines. And I get frustrated, in all honesty, when clients come up and they say, well, I have an executed letter of intent. And as I look it over and I say, well, did you think about these various issues? And they say, no, well, we didn't. And that just makes, you know, everyone's job much more difficult. And it takes some of those expectations and pushes it down at a point in time when you don't want to see that happen, when you want to see the two entities really working together, and you want to see, you know, the anticipation, you know, in their eyes and in their minds as to what can be as a result of those companies coming together.
That's a really good point
that I see.
Yeah, you know, and which really goes to get counsel early on, even before you even get to the point where you're engaging in with somebody. These are that is just so important. We've watched, Mitch, you know, I've talked about this in the past. We've watched people enter into an LOI, and at that point, expectations are set. And anything that you change at that creates suspicion, doubt, concern, and it begins to undermine and tear at the fabric of what you're trying to hopefully have. So that is really good. Alice, when it comes to compliance, any questions for Mitch on the compliance area, regulatory environment, as we're looking at M&A?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Mitch, one of the things we see, obviously, is people perform their due diligence. And sometimes it seems to me in some of the deals I've been involved in, they take that rather lightly. You know, if there's violations, they think, oh, well, I've got systems in place. I can overcome that. There seems to be a lot of I can overcome operational issues. And then, so I'd love your thoughts on that and whether you've seen deals really go wrong because they couldn't overcome what they thought would be solvable operational issues. And then just my second question while I've got you is, have you ever really seen a deal with zero employee fallout, to your point earlier about culture? It seems that in the math, you've got to factor in there's going to be some fallout. So those are my two questions.
Yeah, so as to your latter question, no, I've never seen a deal with zero employee fallout. And yet so many of these deals depend on you maintaining a certain amount of employees through the closing. And as I said, your ability to earn some of your purchase price through the earnout is important to maintaining those employees as well. So that's something that everyone, you know, always needs to think about. Now, in terms of operational issues and things of that sort, yes. I mean, due diligence is absolutely critical, absolutely critical. And more, I see the result of due diligence reports being taken really lightly. Part of that is, you know, we have a new administration and people think, well, enforcement is, you know, is going to be eased off on and, you know, that's not going to be an issue, or we can deal with these particular problems. But nah, you know, it raises issues. We have seen instances where, you know, due diligence will point out a fundamental operational issue, okay? And what you need to do is address it and make a determination as to how you're going to address that operational issue on a go-forward basis rather than just make the assumption that, hey, this is kind of meaningless over here. It's going to be a new entity and we'll be able to walk away from it. You know, I've seen and I've done deals, quite frankly. I've done deals where I've sold companies that were subject to CFPB examinations and CFPB examination reports. And the reality is you can't share those reports or the results of the examinations without CFPB's prior approval. Now, when I buy a company, I get that approval from the CFPB. I jump through those hoops and I tell my client, you need to get this. But I got to tell you something. I've probably done a half a dozen deals in the last year or so, a little more than a year, you know, where my client had outstanding examinations and in some instances outstanding, you know, par letters and things of that sort, where people just said, okay, well, if I can't get it, I'm not going to go to the CFPB and ask for it. So things of that sort are very important. because, you know, if there are enforcement actions that are being taken, not just public enforcement actions, but even private enforcement actions through MOUs and things along those particular lines, it's going to carry over. It's going to carry over to the operation that moved over. And you can't take that lightly. And yet,
yes,
I see that all the time.
And it's those oversights that just create so much, friction in the process, noise in the process, which should otherwise be, you know, if it's well planned in advance, it can go smoothly. I'm looking at the time. Joe, Andy, I'd love to get more questions in, but I want to respect everyone's time here that's listening in and Mitch's time. Mitch, how can people get a hold of you to start the dialogue? If they're, you know, and how do you charge for that? Is this something where you're so good at? And I want to highlight that. I'm asking the question because I know how good you are at giving a lot of information before you're engaged in that. And you're a wonderful resource. So, listeners, I encourage you, if you're considering selling a company, get a hold of Mitch in advance. So, how do you approach this, Mitch? How do you like to, when do you like to get involved? I think the hint is sooner than later. How do we go about it?
Well, first of all, I like to get involved early on. If you're thinking about either buying a company, thinking about selling a company, I like to be there from the very beginning because the advice that I give you really needs to be advice that's given in the beginning and will help you structure your deal properly, think about the issues, many of the issues that we talked about today. You asked how I bill. I mean, I'm a lawyer. For the most part, we bill on an hourly basis. Sometimes for some clients, we'll do some things on a fixed fee basis. But in terms of, you know, the fact that I provide a lot of information to the industry, I love giving back to this industry. You know that. I've represented this industry for a period of 36 years now. And so I'm happy to, you know, get on the phone with you guys, talk on your show. I'm delighted that you invited me to do it and, you know, go out there and give speeches and otherwise help out. If you want to get a hold of me, you do it either by email, you do it by telephone. My email, you know, is kiter@thewbkfirm.com, and my direct dial is 202-557-3511. And I'm happy to talk to anyone that has any questions along those lines. What I typically do, quite frankly, is someone calls me up, ask me your questions. We'll see if we're a good fit first before I'll take on a matter. And you should see that with any lawyer that you talk with as well. Don't just call someone up and have them say, all right, so give me a retainer right now and then I'll talk to you. Because you're never going to determine whether or not you're hiring the right person either.
That's so true. And Mitch, you have been such an advocate. And I want to tell our listeners, I have personally witnessed you giving inordinate amount of time just a very generous amount of time and a lot of wisdom before you ever went to an engagement letter and a retainer. You should get paid for your time. You're a professional and you do. But I tell you, one of the reasons I'm such an advocate of you is the time you give in advance of engagement to make sure it's the right fit for you and for them. I think that's just good business, and you do it so well. I want to say thank you for taking time to join us on this Martin Luther King Day and this holiday, and I really appreciate it. So repeat the email address and the phone number one more time, Mitch.
So the email is kiter@thewbkfirm.com, and the phone number, 202-557-3511.
Appreciate you joining us today, Mitch, and all of our listening audience. And then a special thank you goes to Alice, Andy, Joe, and everybody who participates and is here and makes this program possible, especially our sponsors. Have a great week, everybody. Happy Martin Luther King Day, and look forward to having you back here next week. David Kittle will be our guest. We're going to continue to talk about the trends, what he sees going on within the industry, a leader in the industry on the M&A topic. So we'll be continuing the M&A discussion with David Kittle and some other trends. Mitch, we've got to get you back on here. We can't let it be this long again. We'll look forward to getting you back on another one of the important topics that is out there in the industry. Have a great week, everybody. Look forward to having you back here next week.
You've been listening to Licken on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Licken of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.